Sealand. Young and lovely, hard and strong. For 15,000 years, we've danced your praises, prayed our thanks, and we've just begun. Walks the high country, giving free wild samples and setting an example how to give. Yes, this is my country, fetching and turning like a baby burning how to live. On her tall trees and the corners, my country. Yes, I love her, and I'm learning how to take care of her. When the new stories get me down, I take a drink of freedom to think of my America for a total crown. It's never long before blue, soldier blue. Can't you see that there's another way to love her? Soldier blue, soldier blue. Can't you see that there's another way to love her?
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or you can friend this program on Facebook. Today's program includes Planting the Future, a Kenyan environmentalist and Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Wangari Maathai, founded a grassroots organization that empowers African women to improve their lives and conserve the environment through planting trees. She speaks about the global balance of human and natural resources and shares her thoughts on where God resides. Interviewed by Krista Tippett. And then after that, fourth graders read a credit card agreement. Reading the thing you've never read, your credit card agreement. Does it really have to be so long and complicated? The fourth graders read a credit card agreement and tell us what they think.
Those first women who you had this conversation with, you paid attention to what their needs were, and then you planted these trees. I wanted to know, you know, what effect that had on them, on these women in their lives.
Yeah, one of those women actually that I like to remember was a woman called Priscilla Mereka. She came from the Presbyterian women.
Was she a rural resident also?
Yeah, she was a Kenyan.
Yeah.
And she was representing the Women's Guild in the National Council of Women. So she's one of those women who listened, who were presenting. And later on when I said, why don't we plant trees? And we formed a small committee within the National Council of Women. She became a member of that committee. And we worked together for many years. Unfortunately, she died some years ago, maybe about 10 years ago now. But by the time she died, she had completely transformed her landscape so very much that when they were putting her remains to rest, everybody in the community was praising her, not only for the work that she had done in the church, but the fact that she had brought the Greenbelt movement in her area, that she had facilitated and encouraged the planting of literally millions of trees. And that one thing that I remember women saying is that, you know how you always see these women carrying their firewood on their back, mm-hmm. and there is a typical rope that they use, usually made out of animal hide. And the women said at her funeral that you never see any woman today with that rope because it's not necessary. No woman need carry firewood because the firewood is at the household. And that I thought was such a legacy for her.
I'm Krista Tippett. Today, Planting the Future with the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Wangari Maathai. A biologist by training, she's a celebrated environmentalist and activist for global democracy. She served as the assistant Kenyan Minister of the Environment from 2003 to 2007. We're exploring Wangari Maathai's story and her spiritual and moral bearings. And conversation with her does lead repeatedly back to her sense of the immorality and violent consequences of human recklessness with the environment. In recent years, for example, she's become a key global voice on the issue of encroaching desert or desertification. This ecological catastrophe now threatens the southwestern United States and China, as well as the African continent. About 1 billion people in over 100 countries are potentially affected. Wangari Maathai has been working on the front lines of this crisis for over 3 decades. And when it awarded her the Nobel Peace Prize, the Norwegian Nobel Committee said this: when we analyze local conflicts, we tend to focus on their ethnic and religious aspects, but it is often the underlying ecological circumstances that bring the more readily visible factors to the flashpoint. The committee noted that in places as diverse as the Sudan, the Philippines, Mexico, Haiti, and the Himalayas, deforestation, encroaching desert, and soil erosion are among the present root causes of civil unrest and war. Again, Wangari Maathai.
It is extremely important, and especially for people who live in highly industrialized and rich countries, because people who live in such countries have a feeling that even if they don't have resources within their borders, they can get them mm-hmm. from wherever those resources are. But even if you can buy those resources, even there is a limit to what extent you can get those resources and not create a conflict. Because remember, the resources that are left behind, people have to fight over them.
Right.
And because the world is now so interconnected that when conflict are anywhere in the world, sometimes they come right into your living room, either through television or like now with the Americans being a superpower, a very influential member of the United Nations. If there is conflict somewhere, we are very quick to say we need peacekeeping forces. And these peacekeeping forces are quite often soldiers from areas where there is peace.
Right.
So suddenly you realize you may be in peace, but it is your son or your husband who now has to go and try to keep peace where peace has been threatened. And so it becomes really an important issue for all of us, whether we are rich or we are poor. Recently I was in Japan. I was very lucky because I came across a word called Motainai, which is a Japanese Buddhist concept that is entrenched in the Japanese culture, which encourages people not to waste resources. And this was especially true, they told me.
And it's a spiritual.
Yes, it's a spiritual concept. In fact, this aspect was brought out to me by a monk. I think his name is Monk Mori from Kyoto Temple. We went in and he had heard me use that word publicly, and he said, "I'm so happy you're using that word, mutainai, because it is a word that Japanese don't use anymore because they feel embarrassed to say don't waste resources because they have so much." Mm. Or receive resources with gratitude. Receive what you get from the Mother Earth with gratitude, or from nature with gratitude. And we usually don't think about that. We don't usually thank nature for giving us what she does.
Right.
And it reminded me of the Christian concept of let us be custodians of the environment, of the resources, rather than of
stewardship.
The stewardship thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy that theologians now are really more and more encouraging us to think of ourselves as custodians, mm-hmm. stewards, mm-hmm. rather than domineering masters. Mm-hmm. So this coming from a country like Japan is very, very interesting. It's very interesting, yes. And it's very, very good. And I was very happy that because it was their word, when I started using it, they said, "Oh, this is so wonderful." I said, "Yeah." And especially because in the industrialized countries like America, you have the technology, you have the capital, you have the skills, and you can therefore help to save the resources that are being used in the world. But see, if you become wasteful, if you are not grateful, if you don't recycle, because why should you recycle when you can buy more? You must always remember, but there are billions out there who don't have enough even to survive, let alone to decide whether they should reduce or reuse.
It's hard for people to, for those billions to seem real, you know, to influence little tiny decisions that are made in the course of daily life about whether to recycle something.
Precisely. They look distant because quite often we don't see their faces except when they are dying and their faces are brought to the television in our living rooms. And then we are very quick to call our representatives and tell them, do something about these people who are dying in this corner of the world. But it's happening all the time.
I'm Krista Tippett on Being, conversation about meaning, faith, ethics, and ideas. Today, planting the future with Nobel Peace Prize laureate Wangari Maathai. Up close to Wangari Maathai's visceral courage and hope, it's easy to forget that she was suppressed for a quarter century under the autocratic regime of the former Kenyan ruler Daniel Arap Moi. Arap Moi publicly called her a madwoman. Her Greenbelt movement was driven largely by disenfranchised rural women, improbably confronting powerful elites with a mandate to clear-cut Kenyan forests for economic development. Wangari Maathai was arrested and beaten for protesting illegal logging and land grabbing, and once for leading an historic march of women demanding the release of their sons from Daniel Arap Moi's political prisons. So much of your work has been with women, and you write a lot about the balance of power between men and women. And I wanted to ask if you think of that, the balance of power between men and women, also as a sustainability issue.
The truth of the matter is we are all resources anyway. We are a human resource. And the biggest problem that we have had, especially in the women movement, is trying to convince the other half that we are a very important resource. And we do make great contributions, and therefore we should be respected, we should be appreciated, our work should be quantified, we should be compensated, and that we should not be taken for granted. Now, unfortunately, 30 years ago in 1975, when I, as I said earlier, when we were meeting to go to Mexico, we were going there because we wanted to...
For the United Nations Women's Conference, the first one.
The very first one, and it was at that conference that we declared the Women Decade. Obviously, we have made great strides, and we should be very, very proud of what the strides we have made. But it is true that women are still a very unappreciated resource in many societies. I can see how quickly women, who even very competent women, are sacrificed on the altar of political convenience.
That's a strong sentence. Mm-hmm. Over these years, it's not all been happy ceremonies planting trees. I mean, you've been scorned and you've been pursued and you've been beaten. You've stood up to powerful forces and you didn't know when all this started that it would become so large, that you would found this great movement, that you would win the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, but what kept you going? What were the resources you drew on in the hardest times?
Yeah. Now, again, I would probably say that that is where the experience and the being molded by people of faith made a lot of difference. That although I was not professing my faith, I'm quite sure that I was grounded in that moral fiber of wanting to do the right thing. I was so sure that this was the right thing because I could see it was quite obvious. And even those who were persecuting me knew, and I knew they knew.
Knew that you were doing the right thing?
Yeah, they knew I was doing the right thing.
Okay.
But they didn't want me to do it because it was inconveniencing them. And I knew that, the fact that people have a right to clean drinking water. So anybody who is really polluting that water knows he's doing the wrong thing, knows he should not do. Mm-hmm. Anybody who is interfering with the catchment areas where these rivers come from so that some rivers start drying up, he knows he's doing the wrong thing. And because he's doing it to enrich himself, and he's enriching himself with resources that have been entrusted to him by the public, and he knows the public don't know, and if they know, they are too afraid to challenge him. So me, when I challenge, he can afford to intimidate, he can afford to ridicule, because I'm alone. But I had that conviction that I'm right, and he knows it.
Now, it sounds to me like you always assumed that there was a morality, a conscience somewhere, even inside the people who were, or an ability to see what you saw about what was right.
It was too obvious for people not to see.
Yeah, but it would also have been possible for you to just write these people off, to fight them, to declare them evil. Do you know what I'm saying?
But I didn't have the power to do anything to them.
Right.
They had the power. That's why they could arrest me, they could take me to jail, they could ridicule me publicly. They had the power. I didn't have the power. I couldn't do anything. So the only thing I had, the option I had, was to work with these ordinary people and try to teach them. Initially, I didn't do any teaching, but gradually, when I saw that people were being taken advantage of because they were ignorant, I started reading the Bible, you know, the book of Hosea.
You're reading the prophets.
The prophet. I wanted to know, what did the prophets do when these things happened? And I read about the books of Hosea. Sometimes it's fascinating to read about these old Bible stories and see. And sometimes the stories you read, they are almost replicated in the world we live in. So I read, for example, the book of Hosea quite often. And I think it is chapter 4. And it talks about this prophet who is sent to the people of Israel to tell them they will perish because they are so ignorant. And he said, you are ignorant, and even the priests are ignorant, and you are not listening to the instructions of the Lord, and so you will perish. So I saw literally that our people were perishing because they were ignorant. They didn't understand the linkages between the problems they were facing and the environmental degradation that was happening right there below their feet.
It's an interesting model, too, because it is that what the prophets were doing, what you were doing, in a sense, is railing against your own people on for their sake.
Yeah, telling them that, you know, open your eyes and see that what we are doing is very, very important. And don't be intimidated. Don't be persuaded by these people who are in power, because whatever they are doing it against your good and the good of your children. So at least plant trees, for goodness sake. And by planting trees, you're not harming anybody. You're not harming them.
Right, right.
But I knew that they didn't like what I was doing. And
kind of an ecological form of civil disobedience.
It was,
really, planting
trees. It was indeed. And indeed, it became a symbol of our defiance. Every time, for example, we wanted to protect a forest that the people in power were privatizing, for example, I remember We had a big fight over a forest called the Karura, which is close to the, it is actually within Nairobi, and it is actually essentially the lung of Nairobi, the equivalent of Central Park in New York.
Okay.
And they wanted to clear cut this forest and put up residential houses. And I said, are you out of your mind? You need this forest. And they said, we don't need the forest. We need houses. Now you tell me. So we would take trees and march with our seedlings towards the forest and say, we are marching to go and plant trees. Now, ordinarily, nobody should be bothered about a bunch of women trying to plant a tree. But because we were marching towards this forest, we were essentially saying, you are not going to clear cut this forest. You are not going to put any residential houses in this forest because this forest is needed by the city.
And did you win that battle?
After many years, we won,
okay.
Which is great. And that little forest is still there. Thank God.
We started out talking about growing up and in your culture, trees were holy places, or they created holy places. And you had a Catholic upbringing. I mean, you read the prophet Hosea when you were fighting some of your darkest battles. I want to ask you about your image of God. How do you think about, that's a hard, I don't usually ask people a direct question like that,
yeah.
But I'd be really curious about your response to what is your work with trees? I mean, all the work you've done, the battles you've fought, and, you know, even your new awareness of the importance of democratic spaces. I mean, how does all of that flow into your understanding of these big religious questions?
Yeah. Well, when I was in a Catholic school in Nyeri, which is when I was doing my primary education, I was actually being taught by sisters of the Consolata Order, Order of the Consolata, who come from Milan, by the way. And their founder recently became beatified, by the way, so they are on the right track.
Yeah.
And at that time, I must say that religion was extremely superficial in the way that God was presented to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because God was presented to us in the way he appears in the Sistine Chapel.
Okay.
You know, by Michael Ajero. So at that time, it was I would say a very superficial presentation of God, almost like a human person. And with the minds of a young person, you almost felt like, yeah, God is somewhere in Rome or somewhere in the sky, in the clouds. And then, of course, you remember my own background. And I was already removed from my own background because my parents had already converted into Christianity.
From Kikuyu culture.
Yes, mm-hmm. But there was always that influence of, for example, the fact that they believed that God lived on Mount Kenya.
Yes.
And they had a great reverence to Mount Kenya. And so in the course of my environmentalism, I have often visited those two concepts of the way my ancestors presented God to me and the missionaries presented God
so
to me.
So the Sistine Chapel or Mount Kenya.
Yeah. Now where is God?
Right.
And I tell myself, of course, now we are in a completely new era when we are learning to fight God, not in a place, but rather in ourselves, in each other, in nature. You know, in many ways it's a contradiction because the church teaches you that God is omnipresent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he is omnipresent, he's in Rome, but he can also be in Kenya at the same time if he is omnipresent. So I have had this transformation for me of who God is. I still believe strongly that there is that power, his shape, his size, his color. I have no idea. But you are influenced by what you hear, what you see. But I still, when I look on Mount Kenya, it is so magnificent. It is so overpowering. It is so important in sustaining life in my area that sometimes I say, yes, God is on this mountain.
Before I left Wangari Maathai, I asked her whether music is part of the Greenbelt movement, and she immediately offered to sing me a favorite chorus she often sings with others as they work and meet together.
It says, there is no God like him. There is no love like his. There isn't. There is no love like his. And there is no strength like his. No strength like his. Hakuna Mungu kama yeye, hakuna. Kama yeye, hakuna Mungu kama yeye, hakuna. Mungu kama yeye, hakuna upendo kama wake, hakuna. Kama wake, hakuna upendo kama wake, hakuna upendo kama wake, hakuna nguvu kama zake, hakuna kama zake, hakuna nguvu kama zake, hakuna nguvu kama zake.
Thank you so much, Wangari Maathai.
Most welcome.
Wangari Maathai is the founder of the Greenbelt Movement and the 2004 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Her books include Unbowed, a Memoir, and Replenishing the Earth, Spiritual Values for Healing Ourselves and the World.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.